This is Jim Fester, your host on The Dynamic Doula with Jim and Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. My special guest today is Jerry Liepart, who, if you were to check out the membership list for Scholars for 9/11 Truth, is described as an activist lawyer, an amateur philosopher, and a Quaker peacenik. We're going to be talking about his efforts to contribute to 9/11 research, especially in relation to hearings being conducted by the National Institute for Standards and Technology, which, as most of my audience will know, has been carrying the heavy water for the government with regard to its position on 9/11. But before we get there, I'd like to welcome Jerry to the show and invite him to tell us about more about his background and how he got interested in 9/11. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Jim. It's good to be on. Listen, let me start it this way. I am a lawyer, and I often advise my motor vehicle clients to drive only as fast as the law allows. And I do that because, as a lawyer, I can only advise people to comply fully and completely with the law. Now, as we go in further into our discussion today about NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, the federal agency, as you said, charged with undertaking the review of the destruction of the World Trade Center towers and also an ongoing review of the destruction of World Trade Center building number 7, we are mindful that the people who work at NIST are probably, for the most part, citizens just like the rest of us. And one can further wonder and speculate that they see the same evidence and information concerning the nature of the destruction that took place that day as the rest of us do. We also know that as federal and governmental employees, they are subject to certain benefits arising under whistleblower protection standards. So from a legal point of view, the analogy here is that we would want any and all such employees to disclose only that which the whistleblower laws permit them to disclose. Now, having said that, of course, we want them to do just that.
Are the whistleblower laws written to provide sufficient protection for potential whistleblowers, or do they still leave them vulnerable to all kinds of repercussions from the government or their supervisors?
The practical answer is that the whistleblower protection laws appear at the moment to be insufficient. What we are finding, both in the realm of whistleblower protection, just like within the realm of society at large, there's a great deal of fear. And the fear factor that has been brought on by the enactment of the Patriot Act, by the enactment of the Military Commissions Act, and by what might be considered a mainstream media, you know, participation in this effort to basically induce a climate of fear that people who might otherwise come forward and disclose information that they know to be the basis for fraud or abusive practices simply appear to be afraid to do so. Well, let me say further, Jim, that I'll put it as what you might call a hypothetical or as an anecdote, meaning that this is not something that transpired within my office, but rather there is anecdotal information that right across the country, engineers, scientists, and for that matter, just, you know, thoughtful people and people imbued with a good, you know, level of common sense, have taken a look at information concerning the destruction of the World Trade Center towers and other aspects of 9/11. And let's assume that some of them, let's stick with the engineering group. Let's assume that you have a group of engineers getting together in their offices or in the cafeteria of their workplace or in, you know, the conference room. And let's assume further that they, you know, put up on their bulletin boards or they gather together and look at their computer screens and start looking at some of the information associated with 9/11. Let's say they take a look at, say, the video of the Twin Towers, each collapsing from tippity top to utter bottom in 10 seconds and less. And let's say that as engineers, they start asking themselves questions along the lines that, hey, you know, that's not physically possible absent extraordinary energy inputs or other, you know, queries along those lines put in engineering terms. And then let's suppose that one by one, these engineers get called into their supervisor's offices and are told, hey, you know, Joe, we think we'd like for you to not talk too much about the World Trade Center thing, you know, here in the office. Tone it down a little bit. And so let's say they tone it down a little bit, but nonetheless continue to talk about it amongst themselves. But the nature of those discussions gets back to the supervisory level. And the supervisor then comes in and says, you know, Joe, I got to be quite candid with you. I need for you to drop the discussion of 9/11. Don't say anything further about it. If you do, you're going to lose your job, no questions asked, and I will deny that this conversation ever took place. What to do in a circumstance like that, Jim?
Well, and here we thought we had something called freedom of speech that the Constitution guarantees, Jerry. You know, it's fascinating. I quite agree that we're talking about acts of supererogation that go beyond the requirements of ordinary morality, where persons place themselves in harm's way for the sake of the greater good. And these are individuals greatly to be admired, but they're about as common as hen's teeth.
I'm afraid that's correct, or at least it has been correct up to now. Now let's look at this perhaps from a slightly more optimistic perspective. What I did recently, Jim, was to just do an information search, and the in mainstream media, you know, using database search engines available to me, and I can tell you that the very first article that that I could find, at least in with the engines available to me, that in any way dealt with the
hold that thought, Jerry. We're going to be right back. This is Jim Fetzer on the Dynamic Duo with my special guest, Jerry Liepart. We're talking about 9/11 and NIST. Stand by. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch Kevin here on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. I would observe for the benefit of our audience that Jerry Liepart and I have a relationship beyond this radio program. I have sought him out to secure his advice on legal and ethical issues related to Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and the problems I've had in dealing with a rogue faction that took control of our email list, conducted an unauthorized vote, and has frozen the website and forced me to create a new one at 911scholars.org, a matter that is being formally arbitrated now with respect to the control of the domain names. And it was my great pleasure to meet Jerry in Washington on the 10th of January when I spoke at the National Press Club. So, Jerry, it's a special pleasure for me to have you on with us. Of course, you're an activist attorney who's become interested in 9/11, and you have a special interest in human rights, civil rights, and related issues, which I think is superb.
Well, thank you, Jim, and certainly the honor, indeed the privilege is mine to have that working relationship with you. It is my hope and intent to do the very best I can. And 9/11 is a special issue. It's just so galvanizing once one comes to the realization that not just that it was an inside job, but that this must have involved aggregations of power and of interest groups that that are governmental, that are in the nature of what we refer to as the military-industrial complex, and that is, you know, quite multifaceted. But you know, I also know that as citizens, our first objective inside the 9/11 Truth Movement is first coming to grips with what happened, and then there are additional steps that that we must go through before ultimately coming to the who did this phase. You know, and I, for one, would like to hasten to add that we're not here making, you know, specific accusations that this person, that person, or another person did this, except to say that this had little or nothing to do with 19 hijackers from whatever part of the world they might be said to come from.
How very true, Jerry. How very true. I'd just like to mention, too, that those who are interested in some of the military officers present and past intelligence personnel, government officials, faculty, professors who've taken a keen interest and a stand on 9/11 Truth, please visit 911scholars.org, and immediately at the top left of the page you'll see a yellow box that has three different types of articles. One is 100 professors from different areas of academia who are speaking out about 9/11 in favor of truth, a statement signed by another 100 prominent Americans, and then quite a large and growing list of military intelligence and government officials. But I must say, Jerry, to me it's particularly valuable and rewarding to have someone with your background and level of competence and motivations involved in all of this, because I think we're reaching a point where we desperately need legal guidance and the kind of advice that you're in a unique position to provide.
Well, it's certainly we would like to think that more people in the legal professions, our legal profession at all levels, attorneys, paralegals, law professors, law students, paralegal students, what have you, will start to take an interest in this. I know before the break I was talking about doing mainstream media searches, and what I was about to say was that before approximately June 2004, there had been, you know, virtually no mentions of the concept of 9/11 truth whatsoever. And in mainstream media, even to this day, there haven't been, you know, that many articles about or stories about this this movement. Now, similarly, Jim, you know, you started the you know, Scholars for 9/11 Truth, and you've mentioned some of the growing pains that the organization has had to, unfortunately or fortunately, go through. There also, at this time, is a student Scholars for 9/11 Truth organization in existence. I know I saw a recent, actually, a video clip done by someone in that
Justin
organization.
Justin Martell, who is the yes. founder of Student Scholars for 9/11 Truth from Franklin Pierce College. It probably was the interview with Dennis Kucinich.
That's correct, Jim. That's the piece that I'm referring to. But a search inside media reveals that up until this point in time, at least, there appear to be no other such organizations. In other words, there's no engineer. There's no organization entitled Engineers for 9/11 Truth. There are no doctors for 9/11 Truth. No teachers. Well, I guess scholars, teachers.
Well, there is a Veterans for 9/11 Truth, and there is a Pilots for 9/11 Truth, I'm happy to say. And if
you That's right.
You know, 9/11scholars.org, enroll all the way to the bottom. You can find a list of addresses for other 9/11 Truth sites.
Right.
But I think you're right in the general sense that it would certainly be valuable if there were more and more prominent such organizations.
I suspect that such organizations will start to form. That's my hunch, because I my sense is that the nature of the information, you know, about the event, as well as the recognition that the explanations thus far given are not only inadequate, but that they are, you have to go further than that. You have to go at least to the point of saying they are misleading. And quite frankly, you cannot rule out the use of the words fraudulent and deceptive. And when you start using those words, then those are words that, generally speaking, have legal significance. And that gives us a tie-in or a tie back into the whistleblower concept that we started out mentioning right at the top of the show.
We'll come back to that very idea. Jerry Liepart, my special guest on the Dynamic Duo. This is your host, Jim Fetzer. Stand by. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with Kevin Barrett, where you can catch the Boy Wonder on Mondays and Fridays, and I'm here the rest of the week. I'm very, very pleased today to have as my special guest Jerry Liepart, an activist attorney with a special interest in human rights and civil rights, and who's become intrigued in taking a stand with respect to issues of 9/11. Jerry, please do continue. You were talking again about whistleblowing.
Yes, Jim, thank you. You know, we concluded at a segment where we had gotten over into the realm of saying that there are elements of misrepresentation, indeed of fraud in the way in which the events have been reported on by official governmental sources. Now, having said that, I think it's incumbent upon me, in all fairness, to then be a little bit more specific, you know, to back this up. And so I do so as follows. The third and most comprehensive report done on the destruction of the Twin Towers is that of the National Institute of Standards and Technology, organization known as NIST. And in October of 2005, they issued their final report on the destruction of the Twin Towers that looks on its surface as though it is comprehensive and quite technical and indeed very, very complete. However, in two places, the first one being at page Roman numeral 37 of the executive summary of that report, we find buried in a footnote the following four-line paragraph, which I'm going to read, Jim, for you and the listeners. That paragraph states, and I quote, "The focus of the investigation was on the sequence of events from the instant of aircraft impact to the initiation of collapse for each tower. For brevity in this report, this sequence is referred to as the probable collapse sequence, although it includes little analysis of the structural behavior of the tower after the conditions for collapse initiation were reached and collapse became inevitable," unquote. Jim, that is extraordinary.
It is. It's stunning, Jerry. What it really means is that they don't have an analysis at all of how the buildings came down.
They don't have an analysis of the event
itself. It's going to be hocus pocus. It's going to be flunk your magic twanger, Froggy.
Right. In other words, Jim, all of those video clips, all of those still photographs, all of that data that, you know, we all saw, many of us, as it was happening, you know, I don't think many of us realized that 110-story, 1,360-plus-feet buildings, which when built were the tallest in the world, disappeared in 10 seconds and left a debris pile that was virtually at ground level with nothing above it. Where did the steel go? Where did the rebar go? Where did the concrete go?
And you're talking
other
about
than up
500,000 ton buildings, Jerry.
That's right. And here you have the official governmental report saying, oh, never mind, we're not analyzing that. Jim, that won't do.
Absolutely. That's... you're right, Jerry. And it's easy, I think, to demonstrate, just as you are doing here, that the government's position is completely, hopelessly indefensible. All you have to know is that it's supposed to be a collapse of a 110-story building that's supposed to take place under the influence of gravity, and that the buildings are supposed to have completely collapsed in 10 seconds to realize that it can't possibly be true. As I said, Galileo's law of free fall dictates that objects falling in a vacuum might be able to fall 110 floors, but you're talking about the path of greatest resistance, not the path of least resistance. You're talking about buildings that may have fires on the upper floor, but where the great mass of the building is stone-cold steel that hasn't lost its carrying capacity, that is just as tough and durable and supportive as it ever was. And the whole government story is a fiasco. It's ridiculous and an insult to anyone who knows the least about physics, which I would calculate here is about 10th grade level.
That's right. And so with that understanding and frame of reference, Jim, I simply would be astonished if there were not any number of employees, workers, governmental agents, officials, and contractors who know this as well as you and I know it. Now, that doesn't mean that that this is going to come unraveled tomorrow. There are powerful psychological and just you know, other factors at play here. As citizens, you know, most of us, you know, want to believe only the very best about, you know, the governmental structure, you know, that we have. You know, we may not agree on the specifics of, you know, of one political party or another political party, or here on, you know, progressive talk radio, we might not believe in the, you know, in the political point of view of either of the major parties or consider them to be largely the same. But still, to go to the next step and to have to take into consideration that the leadership factor here is one that involves the ability to carry out, you know, crimes of an unimaginable nature, you know, against us.
Well, we tend to take for granted that our government, at the very least, is responsible for our safety and security. So
that's
the
right.
Idea that the government could actually be perpetrating acts of, well, what turn out to be acts of terrorism by mass murder, for example, of 3,000 of our fellow citizens is certainly a traumatizing thought. I think it enters the domain known as cognitive dissonance, where you are so petrified by new information, and it's so threatening to your core beliefs that you find it almost impossible to absorb or to accept it. I liken it, Jerry, to a woman who has discovered evidence that her husband has been molesting their daughter. It's so traumatic that she may find herself unable to accept it and, in fact, suppress it and allow the molestation to go on.
It's on a collective basis, Jim. I think your analogy is spot on. That's exactly, I think, what we as a society are confronted with. Now, the next steps here. You know what to do about this. I from a legal point of view, and because that is my background and training, that, you know, that's what I can bring to the table. That's what I can add to the mix. And we'll continue, I guess, once that music stops.
We most certainly will, Jerry. Here I am, Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo with my special guest, Jerry Liepart. We're talking about legal and other issues related to 9/11. Stand by. Today, my special guest is Jerry Liepart, who's an activist attorney with special interest in human rights, civil rights, and now 9/11 truth, for which I am most grateful. And Jerry, you know, reflecting on the psychological threat represented by the truth about 9/11, it may be all the more remarkable that the recent New York Times CBS poll showed 53% of the American people are skeptical about what the government has told them about 9/11. Another 28% reject outright what the government has had to say, which means 81% of the American people don't buy it. In fact, only some 16% claim that they accept what the government's told us about 9/11. I think that's quite remarkable.
I do, too. I agree with you, Jim, and it certainly gives us reason to think that we will succeed in cutting through the charade that has gone on thus far. And I'm also very encouraged by the quality of the people who are being brought into the 9/11 truth movement. I've already mentioned that it's an extraordinary honor for me to have had the privilege of working with you. I think on any broadcast like this, I would be remiss in not mentioning someone who I have utmost admiration for, and that is Dr. Judy Wood. I'm astonished, Jim, with the level, the quality, and the sophistication of the research work that Dr. Wood has done. I know she has been a guest on your show and likely will be again very soon.
As soon as tomorrow, Jerry.
As soon as tomorrow. So, you know.
Well, Judy is exceptional. She is, in my opinion, the single most highly qualified student of the case with degrees in civil engineering, engineering mechanics, and structure engineering science. So it's really quite stunning what she brings to the table.
You know, earlier,
for all those reasons, she's very threatening to those who would just assume that the truth not be revealed, and that makes her a prime target. I have learned from research in JFK that the more you're attacked and the more viciously, the more likely it is that you're onto something terribly, terribly important, and I do believe that to be the case in relation to Judy.
That is correct. I agree with that. I want to pass on. I know we're getting close to the end of the segment, Jim, but I want to pass on this you know, anecdote about the fear factor that that we touched on earlier in the show. I have this information in front of me. It came across in a in an email that headlined, Kentucky teacher placed in psych ward for declaring 9/11 was an inside job.
Isn't that stunning?
And then it goes on to say, it lists his name.
I know him. I've had conversations with him. His name is Michael Cook, and actually he's a nephew of a philosopher at the University of Cincinnati that I know well. And I'm just distraught over this. It seems such a gross abuse for him to be in this situation. And I at one point thought that it might be possible to use his case as an opportunity to bring expert testimony about 9/11 into the courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
But the way in which it was handled, his attorney, with whom he had an ambivalent relationship and actually fired at one point in time, wound up entering into a plea bargain that may or may not have been in his best interests, which has led to this result.
Okay. Well, on that note, let me mention then legal approaches that you know, that I and others are, you know, are contemplating. Now, you know, first of all, within NIST, they do and they are obliged to comply with the Freedom of Information Act. So you can certainly ask NIST for information. NIST also claims to comply with what's called the Data Quality Act, or DQA, an act that has only been on the books for a little over 6 years now. I think it went into effect sometime in the year 2000. And because it's new and because its provisions are a little bit obscure, there hasn't been a lot of legal activity under the DQA, the Data Quality Act. But I can tell you that I've very recently, as in the last couple of hours, received a communication assuring me that NIST claims to have complied with the DQA, and under the DQA, you can institute legal challenges where you have reason or grounds to believe that the requirements for data quality have not been adhered to. So, based upon what we read earlier about how this very sophisticated NIST study on the destruction of the World Trade Center Twin Towers did everything except analyze the actual destruction, I think we've got data quality issues.
Well, I think that's fantastic, Jerry, because this administration has shown such stunning arrogance with respect to its refusal to comply with any kind of transparency of information, going all the way back, of course, to that energy policy meeting where Cheney wouldn't even allow the names of the participants to be released, even though it turns out in retrospect that I think at that meeting they were basically ratifying an agreement to turn the foreign policy of the United States over to the multinational oil companies. It's stunning to me how much the Americans have lost control of their government during this administration.
It is stunning, Jim, and it... The ramifications and consequences may take decades to recover from once we regain our senses and realize the full nature and extent of the hole that is being that we've been put into. It's going to take some time. This time is as one of the song lyrics might say, Jim.
It may take great diligence and dedication on the part of a new Congress or several in succession to try to set things right, even just from the point of view of the policies that have been abrogated or dismissed by this administration.
Yeah. It seems to me that the way forward is to continue to unearth the information that is consistent with demonstrating that what passes for the myth of what happened is just that, a myth, and that once we get enough information as to what happened out there and in front of enough people, I feel certain that a tipping point will be reached, and that that tipping point will be demonstrated by a combination of enough citizens knowing that something has to be done about this, who will in turn pressure, and literally that pressure, their governmental representatives, and that percolating in the background, I feel certain that employees who have knowledge, governmental agents, will come forward.
We'll be
in
right
their
back with my
two.
Special guest, Jerry Liebhart, discussing legal and other aspects of 9/11 research. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on the Dynamic Duo. Stand by. My special guest today is Jerry Liebhart, an activist attorney who's taken a special interest in 9/11. Jerry, I must say, against the background of our previous conversation, I think that we're fortunate to be getting a breadth of coverage now that spans many different kinds of magazines. For example, there's a four-page article in Hustler for March that includes two pages on the science of 9/11 and two pages on the politics. And then the Nation magazine, in their issue of 5 February 2007, published seven letters to the editor in response to an article that appeared in December that was attacking 9/11 students as though they were paranoid. It included even a long letter that I had written that enumerates about two dozen reasons why the government's account can't be taken seriously. And yet I believe that foreign interest seems even greater than American interest. I had a crew from the BBC come here to Madison and interview me for 8 hours back in November for a special on the 9/11 conspiracy that's yet to be played, but it's in the same series with the program they have played on the death of Princess Diana. And then just last month I was flown to Athens, Greece, actually December, by the leading investigative journalist for Athens and put on a 3.5-hour program, if you can believe that, that was broadcast by satellite worldwide. I just don't see that kind of response coming from our media, nor would I expect it, given how much our media are dominated by big corporations and how closely they're allied with the Bush administration.
That's absolutely spot on, Jim. It's for me, I almost want to say a source of embarrassment, but certainly a source of bewilderment that much of the coverage about the truth of 9/11, and that is to say the falsity of the official explanations, either originated abroad, mostly in Europe, and or certainly gets and receives, much more significant coverage in their mainstream media, outlets. For us,
a couple of the earliest books, for example, were by Thierry Meissen on Pentagate and 9/11, The Big Lie, mm-hmm. which were, early works that drew my attention, and certainly I found them quite convincing that something was terribly, terribly wrong about the story we'd been told about the Pentagon.
Yeah, right at the outset, I guess I dodged a question that you asked of, how did I get, involved in 9/11 truth movement, and the fact of the matter is that on the day of 9/11 itself, I actually had flashbacks to, November 23rd or 22nd of 1963, when on that day, and certainly, by the day or so later when we all, saw Oswald, get shot dead while in police custody.
Right, Jack was assassinated on Friday the 22nd, and Oswald was shot on Sunday the 24th.
Okay, I knew you'd know that. I knew then as a as a teenager, and I guess I've dated myself somewhat there, but nonetheless, I knew as a teenager that did not happen, absent there being, a plan, absent this being a planned assassination. And on 9/11, I had similar, fleeting and initial thoughts about, what I was seeing. This does not happen absent a plan. And I think in the, on the internet, I actually posted and then, wrote to a number of people that, at the very least, I thought there were very strong international forces, behind this. And then I just, let it go for a while. And it was probably in the year 2005. I don't think it was before that the phrase, 9/11 was an inside job, began to circulate certainly around the internet in various, communications, chat rooms, message boards, and news blogs of one sort or another. And I actually did not get on board with those right away. I stayed apart from those, and I think my position at the time was that this isn't going to go anywhere, so we may as well, just leave it alone. And it was not until the spring or summer of 2006 when the some of the more polished, longer length videos started coming out. And quite frankly, the turning point for me was taking a look at Loose Change. I found that to be to be, you know, just a bit too compelling to turn away. And in particular, for whatever else you might want to say about the accuracy of loose change, what it did hammer home for me was that you had 110-story buildings utterly self-destruct in 10 seconds. And to this day, Jim, I know there are many who say that the single strongest facet of 9/11 truth is that of the speed with which the buildings were destroyed. And as I said, for whatever else one might say about loose change, it did illustrate the speed and the utter pulverization, you know, that took place, that made it quite clear, you know, right then and there, that whatever was going on there was not and could not have been the result of plane damage, kerosene, because that is what jet fuel is. It's not even flammable. It's a combustible. You know, and gravity. You cannot get the destructive effects seen with those energy inputs.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Jerry. I do think that loose change has been a major force for good and has been actually a cultural phenomenon. It's been downloaded from the Internet something like 10 million times, and now they have a huge budget to produce a documentary for general theater release, which I'm very much looking forward to. There has been a study about the frequency with which articles about 9/11 were taking place. And in fact, right up until through December of 2005, it was virtually a flat line of virtually no coverage. Mm-hmm. And I have to believe that somehow creating the organization of scholars and putting out press releases and taking stands and having members identified with this organization, giving lectures and writing articles and all that, has had a difference, because from that point on, there's a steady increase in the number of hits, the number of articles of one kind or another that are appearing related to 9/11, up to the point where we reach a crescendo with the American Scholars Conference in Los Angeles in June, when C-SPAN broadcasts the panel discussion that involves four members of scholars: Steve Jones, the physicist from BYU, Bob Bowman, the former director of the Star Wars research program under Reagan, who has a PhD in nuclear engineering from Caltech, Webster Tarpley, who may be our most sophisticated student of covert operations and false flag maneuvers, and myself as the founder of Scholars. And when that was broadcast finally by C-SPAN, they picked a very good time. Saturday, they did it repeatedly. They did it again on Sunday, then again on Tuesday. I think that legitimated public discussion of 9/11.
I think you're absolutely right, and that's what we're seeing. The news stories picking up with both frequency and accuracy in the year 2006.
We'll be right back with my special guest, Jerry Liebhardt, on the Dynamic Duo. Stand by. And I'm here the rest of the week with my special guest today, Jerry Liebhardt, who is an activist attorney who has taken a keen interest in 9/11. Jerry, just to make one reflective remark and then to offer another observation, the reflective remark being, I think the reason why loose change and scholars has had an interaction is because loose change makes a lot of claims about what happened, and scholars is in a position to back it up, even if in some cases it's a matter of fine-tuning. And the fact that there is a group of professionals, of experts, academicians, people who are skilled in research across a variety of disciplines, including, of course, physics and aeronautical engineering and civil engineering and engineering mechanics and so forth, I think it has made a world of difference here, and that there's been an interaction phenomenon that's made it work. Now, my opinion, and this may sound surprising, is that I actually think most of what we have to contribute has already been accomplished, because I believe that we have brought the public to a point where they're largely, by and large, you know, grabbing onto these issues for themselves and trying to figure out what's going on, so that we remain as a resource to be consulted, but where I think the public has definitely got the score. Let me give you an illustration. There's a hit piece that's being discussed on the net right now out of the UK on the 9/11 movement, and it has drawn literally hundreds and hundreds of responses, almost all of which are critical in explaining why this guy you know, has his head where the sun doesn't shine. Well, that tells me an awful lot of people know what's going on. I have a friend here, right here in Duluth, who's a mortgage broker, who tells me about friends he has that are interested in 9/11, and tells me when he rides the bus how he runs into people who are talking about 9/11. Some of them even have copies of DVDs that they're giving away. I mean, to me, this is fairly astonishing. It's become a real social phenomenon.
I agree. I'm hopeful along those lines. And really, that is the story. But as it is with most instances of discussion and of public interest, there's always another side, and so we know that as well. And there are two things that. That I want to address. One is I want to mention a bit more about possible legal action that looms out there, and the other issue is the extent to which there's a tendency to want to create an orthodoxy about or within the 9/11 truth movement that seems to involve the assessment of what part of truth can be successfully presented to the public and what part of it we must either pretend does not exist or we must disown.
Well, this, of course, was a major issue that led to the differences with this rogue group who really largely coalesced around Steve Jones and his thermite hypothesis, which I no longer found all that significant with regard to its explanatory power, with regard to the totality of evidence we have about the destruction of the World Trade Center as a whole. In fact, I was just noticing that in his book on in 9/11 and American Empire, co-edited by David Ray Griffin and Peter Dale Scott, he's actually what I think may be an alteration in the title. He's talking about the destruction of the World Trade Center. Why indeed did the WTC buildings collapse? Well, that's quite a span when you talk about the WTC buildings. You're not just talking about one and two, the Twin Towers. You're talking about 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. And while I think every serious student recognizes that Building 7, which went down at 5:20 in the afternoon, having been hit by no airplane, no jet fuel-based fires, etc., is a special case and a very obvious example of a classic controlled demolition, my principal concern about Steve's hypothesis is that even if it were good as gold with respect to the Twin Towers, which I do not believe is the case, I don't see how it can possibly explain the collateral damage or the additional destruction of Building 3, 4, 5, and 6, which some of these buildings had very peculiar features with regard to the damage wrought upon them, such as 6 having a huge carved-out cavity that was, essentially the complete and total destruction of a major portion of the building in the center. Very, very strange. I mean, it was reminiscent to me of when around 1983 I lost my right kidney. I mean, a surgeon went out there and extracted that kidney, and there was an empty space. Well, it's like that building had a surgical extraction right from the center of the building. Or take WTC-3, which has this huge gouge in it as though a gigantic Paul Bunyan, hit it with his axe. I cannot see any way, shape, or form that the thermite hypothesis for the Twin Towers can explain that. And not to mention, of course, the lack of functional damage to the bathtub, by which I mean the bathtub. The function of the bathtub was to hold back the water of the Hudson River so it wouldn't flood the subways and underneath the structures in lower Manhattan and the PATH train tunnels over beneath the Hudson River to Newark. I mean, if those 500,000-ton buildings had come down in the bathtub, it would surely have been shattered. Its functional capacity would have been destroyed. You would have that water flooding. It would have been a massive mess of humongous proportions, and yet that didn't happen. And, of course, Judy Wood has offered the hypothesis that the buildings are actually, you know, when they're, as they're being destroyed from the top down, this pulverization is taking place, and all that mass of the building is being converted to very fine dust, which requires an enormous source of very powerful energy. I just don't see that thermite or thermate, even in its so-called super thermate version, can do that. I certainly haven't seen evidence it can do it, although that is Steve's hypothesis.
I fully agree with that, and a process that that takes place is that you know, we mentioned loose change, which really only became a phenomenon in the year 2006. But as a, you know, as a bit of data or as a source of information, it's fair to say that much of what that and other popular videos discuss is now outdated by additional research.
Well, that's true, but I think it certainly can get people hooked where they can get familiar with some of the basics. We'll be right back with my special guest, Jerry Liepart. This is Jim Fetzer on the Dynamic Duo. Today, my special guest is Jerry Liepart, an activist attorney who's taken a keen interest in 9/11. The question I was going to raise too, Jerry, and we can come back to some of these issues, was that during my period in Athens, I would make, you know, try to keep up on what was going here by visiting an internet cafe, and an awful lot of what was taking place at that very point in time was this NIST public hearing, which you were seeking, where you were seeking to make contributions to, and as I recall, it had to do with Building 7, and it was kind of surprising to me that you were, you know, taking a lead role, which I thought was very appropriate and I admired, but where I would have thought it was even more reasonable to suppose that someone like, say, Steve Jones might have been taking a lead role, and it appears to me that he wasn't, which is, I don't know, a little perplexing.
Well, you know, I think I would try to avoid a comment that was in that was, you know, that was openly critical. And let me say this about the 9/11 truth movement. You know, I think we're better off by, you know, focusing on the research by providing a format providing not so much a format but a welcome mat for other citizens to come into this movement and to be accepting of the notion that you know, people are going to have different and differing, you know, points of view. As you know, Jim, I think that we'd be well advised to do all we can to encourage whistleblowers to come forward, to let them know that you know, they will be respected, that their anonymity will be protected, and that you know, we are not looking to, you know, to cross-examine them on, you know, how could you have done this, but rather we all realize the seriousness of the situation that we are in, the dire straits that the country that that we live in and have our citizenship in and have our families in, you know, have been placed.
Actually, the only reason I make the point is by way of contrast. I mean, Steve's obviously not the only one who might have been in a position to do this. So too could, say, Jim Hoffman or Eric Hufschmidt, mm-hmm. who have done extensive analyses of the, you know, the destruction of the Twin Towers and Building 7. It's just that for you to be the one who winds up taking that fairly lead role in relation to Building 7 is rather surprising, given that there are others who are, you know, in relation to their scientific credentials or their background with regard to study here, seemingly more obvious candidates. So in a way,
well,
I just want to compliment you, Jerry, because you did it. I mean, it's like when I founded the society. I mean, I gather that some people have been kicking around the idea, but I did it, just as here, you know, other people might have been mm-hmm. thinking about doing it, but you did it. And I'm so glad you have, because it seems to me if you're finding some legal avenues of raising additional issues here that might lead to further exposure of the failure of the government to account for anything, you know, even as blatant a phenomenon as what happened to Building 7, which is such a stunning contradiction to the whole official government account that it's not even mentioned in the 9/11 Commission report. I mean, you're doing something extremely important, it seems to me, where there was a window of opportunity that was destined to be closed, and where it's very evident from the email exchanges that I've read involving your efforts that there was a powerful effort being made to close it by NIST itself.
Well, that's right. Let me, I'm gonna address, you know, the lawyers, you know, in the audience, just a bit. Building 7 may not be the what you might refer to as the sexiest part of the 9/11 truth movement. However, NIST has not yet completed its investigation of what caused the, and I think we can use the word collapse as it applies to Building 7.
Yes.
So, therefore, the investigation is ongoing. Now, from a legal point of view, you have more legal options available to you as to what you can do at a time when a governmental investigation is ongoing rather than after that investigation has been completed and a report issued. So, therefore, while Building 7, you know, may not be the most dynamic part of 9/11 truth, it is, in a certain sense, Jim, the only game in town that offers the possibility of certain kinds of legal intervention that are precluded once the report has been issued.
Well, I'll tell you, Jerry, actually, I think most students of 9/11 are convinced that Building 7 is the most blatant smoking gun. And it presents many fewer challenges to analyze, and in that sense, maybe it's less sexy, but I think everyone finds it such powerful evidence. Well, even Steve Jones, for example, when he went on Tucker Carlson, was intent upon showing footage of Building 7 coming down because it exemplifies all those characteristics of classic controlled demolition. But, of course, Tucker wasn't disposed to have it shown, or his producer, so they only showed a still, which obviously doesn't get across all the points that Steve wanted to make. So I think there's actually a general consensus that Building 7 is maybe the most sensational and easily explainable contradiction or contradictory evidence refuting the government's account.
Well, that's right. They will have. They certainly are going to be very, very highly challenged to comply with the requirements of data quality on one hand, and come to some conclusion other than controlled demolition occurred there on the other. And in a certain sense, it may only take one instance of controlled demolition to unravel the entire myth of what occurred on September 11th of 2001.
I think you know, that's right, Jerry. And, you know,
that's
the situation
an extraordinary
is so bizarre
opportunity.
When you have, I mean, Larry Silverstein unwisely giving his interview, you know, on PBS, and we've got this archived now account of him explaining how he said to the fire commander, and his verbal pause indicating to me that he knew this guy under a different designation as the, you know, that perhaps the best thing to do was to pull it, and that they made the decision to pull, and we watched the building come down. I mean, this is all very blatant. I mean, you've seen there's some fantastic efforts out there to try to explain away, you know, his having said what he said and its meaning what it meant. And as a philosopher who deals with syntax, semantics, and pragmatics, the philosophy of language is my principal tool of investigation. I can assure you, you cannot justify an alternative interpretation on a basis of syntax or of semantics or of pragmatics. I mean, it all fits. What he was calling for was the controlled demolition, the destruction of the building, and it can only have been done by his suggestion if the explosives were already previously positioned in the building, and if they were previously positioned in Building 7, then why not also in 1 and 2? So I think there's an inevitable series of questions and answers that is extraordinarily embarrassing for the government.
And NIST has subpoena power, so we'll touch on that a little more.
My special guest today has been Jerry Liepart, an activist attorney who has a special interest in human rights and civil rights, and in this case 9/11, and has become involved in with NIST having public hearings in relation to Building 7. And I think it's extraordinarily important that you have been doing this, Jerry, and I want to compliment you for that, because it requires a certain amount of motivation, dedication, and perseverance to tackle a project like this.
Well, it's certainly not easy, and often we have to measure successes not in the traditional ways of winning a case or losing a case, but rather in advancing the cause of truth by virtue of the case, irrespective of outcome. Now, let me mention the False Claims Act, okay? Under the False Claims Act, there may be a vehicle for bringing civil actions against not just governmental entities and governmental players, but also against private contractors. NIST, for example, sublet a good bit of the work done in coming up with its report on the destruction of World Trade Center 1 and 2, and is likewise doing the same thing in the ongoing study of World Trade Center 7 to private entities.
So you're going to be outsourcing everything these days, Jerry.
Yeah, that's right. It's very common.
There.
Right. Now, the same questions that we're asking of governmental players, we can ask of representatives of private contracting firms. Do they know, or should they, that the work they are engaging in amounts to fraud and the presentation of false information to the public? If it does, then that information can lead to both criminal and criminal prosecutions and civil cases. In the civil cases, those who are instrumental in bringing forward the information get to recover money damages, being a portion of any money that the government recoups as a result of the false or fraudulent claims that will have occurred. We give the name to such actions based on the Latin phrase of qui tam. And I can tell you, Jim, that, again, speaking to the lawyers who might be out there, that this is an area worth additional review and research and consideration. We do need to determine whether and to what extent the False Claims Act might be applicable here. Now, you know, we say this not as a threat, but you know, this is law. It's legal procedure. It's lawful process. Where something improper has been done, then it is incumbent upon us to determine whether a legal remedy should be pursued.
Well, I think it's a great angle, Jerry. I mean, I love that you're looking at all these things, because you're going to have a way of approaching this that most of us simply are oblivious to by virtue of our lack of legal training and acumen.
Well, I know I'm not the only lawyer who is looking at this information. I know that there are some others, and I suspect that that in every region of the country, this sort of approach may be percolating in the background. I mean, I would be astonished if one or more lawyers have not been in every region of the country, in every state, because every state has significant defense contract work going on, and these things are interrelated. And I just the anecdote that I mentioned of engineers talking about 9/11 and being told to stop. I suspect that you have incidents like that taking place right across the country. And sooner or later, some of these people are going to make their way into lawyers' offices asking for advice on whether and to what extent their activities are covered by whistleblowing, protection statutes, and other employee rights protections. And I'm reasonably confident that there will be developments in those line along those lines that will combine with other sources of information and other pathways to bringing 9/11 truth right out into the forefront. And Jim, I'm going to go further than that. I think the task here may be that of preparing the country for a truly cathartic experience that might help us come to grips with getting out from under the so-called military-industrial complex once and for all. That is my hope.
Oh, Jerry, that's so devoutly to be wished. I mean, I have said before that every competent structural engineer in the country, indeed in the world, has to know that what the government's told us about 9/11 can't possibly be true. And the fact that they're holding their tongue and not speaking out is, to me, profoundly troubling. On one program, I even said quite forcefully that there was a special place in hell reserved for these people who know that what the government's saying can't possibly be true and yet are not speaking out. And, of course, you're talking about the context in which they find themselves, where their very livelihood, their present positions may be in jeopardy. They may be subjected to threats. They may be feeling, you know, forms of intimidation from their employers, who often have major government contracts. So I concede that there can be a lot of special circumstances, but we're talking about, you know, the nation. We're talking about its future. We're talking about the integrity of government. We're talking about the democracy. We're talking about truth, justice, and the American way. We're talking about what this country is supposed to stand for and represent. And this is such a gross, calamitous contradiction right to the very core of American values that it seems to me that anyone, a citizen who really cares about his country, has no choice, must speak up. And I call upon them to do so. And I hope that you and others in the legal profession can provide them with the kind of assistance they need to feel comfortable in doing that.
Well, the remedies are available. That said, it does take a bit of courage. You know, one of the most difficult moments I had was when, you know, someone, you know, asked me, you know, sort of in a way that said, well, if what you're saying about 9/11 were true, then, you know, wouldn't there be a lot of engineers and others coming forward to, you know, to disclose this information? You know, and you want to say, well, yeah, fat chance. I mean, you know, people, all, you know what, Jim? All it took was perhaps that one incident involving none other than Kevin Ryan.
Over him to be fired from Underwriters Laboratory.
From Underwriters Laboratory,
pointing out that they had their figures wrong about the melting point of steel and the testing of the steel by Underwriters Laboratory.
That's right. Just for mentioning. Now, keep in mind that occurred early on. And the rest, as they say, is history, Jim. It set us back, but I think people are going to start coming forward, ones and twos, trickled in a flood.
I can't thank you enough for coming on the dynamic duo, Jerry Liepart. I want to have you back again. This is Jim Fetzer, your host. Thank you all so much for listening.